Welcome to Books Plus on RN and Radio Australia. I'm Kate Evans with a pile of novels that touch on ghosts, spirits and the dead in very different ways. Jim Bernard is interested in how well-known authors have died and how they wrote and thought about death. While in M.R. Carey's Fellside, a woman is haunted by the ghost of the child she murdered. Things aren't so dark in Ben Aronovich's Rivers of London series, though. Ben Aronovich is a novelist and scriptwriter. Among other things, he was the first to make Daleks levitate in Doctor Who. But it's his fiction that we're going to talk about today. He's written five books so far in his Rivers of London series. They're police procedurals with a twist. Punch and Judy shows are real. There are jazz vampires born in the Blitz. And the theatres and laneways of the city have spectres, demons and a whole pantheon of gods. And, of course, they also have their own very small unit of the Metropolitan Police to keep an eye on magical transgression. I met Ben Aronovich while he was in Sydney. Ben, what does London mean to you?
I love London. I've always loved London. I've always loved London more than, say, my brothers and sisters have loved London. I just have always loved the history and everything about it. I'm like one of those mad New Yorkers who loves New York. I love London. I make no bones about it. I know it's a terribly imperfect city. If you've ever tried to get around it by bus, you'll know that. But, you know, it's where I grew up. It's where I live. I miss it. I get a nosebleed when the population density falls below about 7,000 per square mile. And if I'm away for more than a couple of weeks, I get really kind of antsy.
So is it fair to say then that this series, this Rivers of London series, is like an odd love letter to your city?
Well, it's not an odd love letter. It's just a love letter. Yes. I think in a sense because I'm writing it, you know, it's a love letter because I'm in love with my city and this comes through. When you're writing, it's very hard to be terribly deceptive in writing. Some people can do it very well. But whereas you can lie about all sorts of things when you're writing, your underlying passions are very hard to disguise. And I think my love of London just comes through the books because I have an enormous love of London. And it helps me that my main character, you know, shares this affliction. And so therefore, it sort of fits the theme.
Well, I guess I said an odd love letter because this series is so imbued with the history and the architecture and the life of London, but you twist it, you play with it. So perhaps we should start with who your main man is.
My main man.
Introduce us to him.
Well, PC Peter Grant is, when we first meet him, just finishing his probationary period. That's the two-year period every metropolitan constable has to do where he's just pounding the streets and being taught the ropes and is waiting to find out which direction his career will take. And he's a fairly ordinary guy. I mean, he's from North London. He's from a place called Kentish Town, or actually a place called the Peckwater Estate on Leighton Road, for any of you that know Kentish Town quite well. He's a working-class guy. He joined the police mainly because he kind of, like, messed up his A-levels. And then he kind of drifted around a bit, and he became a PSCO, which is a police community support officer, which is like a semi-police role. And like a lot of PSCOs, he kind of caught the bug for the job and then he applied. It's much easier to apply for the police once you've been a PCSO because you've done a lot of the vetting and you know a lot of the procedures. And then he applied and he took it up and he found he's got a real love for policing. The trouble is he's a little bit too easy distractible. A lot of his colleagues think he's not quite street enough to kind of like be a policeman. Being a policeman, you've got to be aware of your situation all the time. You've got to be quite aggressive. You've got to be not worrying about the architectural details over a sort of particular moulding over a house when you're walking down the street. You're supposed to be keeping your eyes kind of more firmly on what you're doing. And although Peter's a very good policeman in some ways, he's got that little kink that makes his colleagues and his superiors just a little bit worried about how good he is going to be. I always like to think he would have gone on to quite a good career, but mostly in the kind of like specialist field. He would have ended up in something like arts and antiques or the Serious Fraud Office or something like that, doing something that was quite specialist rather than street policing.
Because he is passionate about the architecture of his city.
Yes.
But he's also very attuned to what a complex city London is. His mother is from Sierra Leone, and you have all sorts of characters, including the goddess of the rivers, who have African and other backgrounds. How important was it for you to show how much London is a cosmopolitan city?
I've been in this fight with the media essentially since my career started, where I've tried to portray London as the London that I live in, and they've tried to take all the black characters out because they don't like them. And that's essentially been my career. And
you'd have to work hard to find a purely white London, though, wouldn't you?
Well, you know, they seem to manage it quite well. If you watch my TV, they work very hard. It's like the very white New York in Friends. It's like this magically whiteified city and things like Friends and, you know, New Girl and all the other kind of stuff in America. You have to remember that most people writing and stuff set in London are not Londoners. They're from outside London. They're from the lily white suburbs and stuff. And they work in an industry that's very white.
Well, and you do embed this multicultural cosmopolitan city into everything that's there. But I did slip in there a reference to a goddess of a river. So you're very interested in the history of London. But perhaps we can talk about what version of London it is that Peter engages with. You know, he's a PC, he's a regular plod. And the way that we start to see his London happens in the first book. He's policing a crime scene. He ends up talking to a witness. What's special about this witness?
Well, the witness is a ghost. I mean, this essentially was the only thing I knew right at the start of the book, that he meets a witness and the witness turns out to be a ghost. And this is the thing that really defines his character and the reason which sets him off on his career, his slightly alternative policing career, is that he then takes a witness statement from it. And this is because Peter thinks in terms of systems, that it's just the way his brain works. Some people do. And he doesn't think to himself, oh, it's a ghost! Ah! He just thinks, right, well, it's a ghost, but he still saw what happened, and so therefore I'm going to take a witness statement from him. And it's that quality that kind of endears him to the person he meets next, which is Inspector Nightingale, who runs the Metropolitan Police, very, very small magical department.
Well, and that's what's so playful and funny, and these are terribly, terribly funny books, is that on the one hand, it's a straight police procedural within all the constraints of a police system, and they somehow have to work out how to accommodate. I mean, what do they call it? Like all of the funny bugger stuff.
Well, they call it weird shit or weird, you know, no, that's strange. I mean, like Stephanopoulos and Seawald, who are the two very, very straight police officers who, you know, don't want anything to do with this stuff. They call it weird shit all the time. They go, we don't want any of that kind of weird shit. And especially Seawald, who swears like a trooper. And they do have a term for it. They call it full. See, when Peter joins this thing, his tendency to think in terms of systems means he immediately starts trying to drag this magical department into the 21st century. And one of the first things he does is regularize call signs. See, specialist units in the Metropolitan Police have call signs. And being the police, these get turned into verbs and adjectives fairly quickly. So, for example, the call sign for, I think, well, they change quite a lot as well, for armed response is Trojan. So you will say, oh, it's a Trojan matter, or it's a Trojan, or we need to Trojan this. And that means basically it's now something the way you need an armed response. And for the magic police, it becomes Falcon. So it's a Falcon response. And so everyone goes, oh, God, this is getting weird. Let's make it a Falcon case and get them in.
And part of the way that Peter then works with the head of this, as you say, very small magical department, is that when a peculiar crime happens, they try to see whether there's any magical stuff going on. And part of it is by finding traces.
Yes, the vestigia.
Vestigia.
Or vestigium. I can never remember which is the plural for that.
But in the second book, Moon Over Soho, the vestigium is a jazz track, and so he becomes the jazz police, which is terribly funny.
Yes. Happened by accident.
How important is it to you to be playful in the midst of
this. Well, you see, what I love is the clash between... See, one of the reasons why I make it as realistic as I can on the policing side is because the more realistic the policing, the funnier it is, the intersection between the policing and the supernatural. And what if you do, if you make the policing, in a weird way, if you try and make the supernatural also as realistic as you possibly can, then the funnier the clash between them and the more interesting the clash. So, you know, and I always think of it, I use this example, although I've never had werewolves in the series, is like... Under the European Human Rights Convention, right, if you lock up a werewolf, is that animal cruelty? But if you put a werewolf in a kennel, is that in violation of the European Convention on Human Rights, you see? And I love that, the fact that that's actually quite a crucial question, because if he puts him in a kennel and it turns out to be a violation of his human rights, he could blow the whole case. See, so, and I love, the more realistic it is, the more fun you get those kind of like conflicts and everything. And I like playful, and I tried writing quite serious, but it never stays serious for very long.
But on the other hand, I can see your commitment to the history of London. So in one book, the whole history of brickmaking and navvies and building the sewers is treated quite seriously and respectfully, and it's something that Peter's very interested in. But then we find out there are this whole other community of people, the quiet people, who live under the sewers. So is it important to you that it is based on historical research as well?
The thing about London is you don't so much go looking for history as you, like, you lift up a stone and then you duck as all this history comes, like, it's like lifting up and a geyser of history comes out. And really part of your problem is choosing the bits you're going to use. I never ever say to myself, oh, if only there was more history that I could dig up out of this. Really, you know, you'd have to take an umbrella. You get wet looking for history in London. And of course, the closer you get into the historic centre, the more and more history per square inch you get. So it really becomes a question of what history you use, you know, and how much. How much do you think your audience can bear?
Well, you do get wet, and it is called the Rivers of London series. Is that where you started? Tell us how important the rivers are.
Well, that's a very interesting question. You see, stories, often ideas for stories come from several different directions and several different projects. And I like to think of it as you have this kind of like back burner space in your brain where you put kind of ideas that are almost but not quite there, and you put them there and they kind of cogitate. And often what happens is you'll take one idea from one thing and you'll take another idea from something else and you kind of fit it together and you go, aha, that fits together perfectly. And I had the idea of essentially the Sweeney Meads Ars Magica, which is actually in my brooch, means nothing to 90% of the population. And I thought, right, well, magic cops was basically my thinking. When you're a writer, you spend a lot of time kind of like watching other people's programs thinking, well, I wonder what would happen if that did that or you did that, or could I nick that element and steal it and file the serial numbers off and do something else with it? And one of the ideas I had was, what if Harry Potter, what if Hogwarts had been a comprehensive school? Basically, what if that would have been like? And I wasn't really developing it seriously as an idea, but it just kind of stuck in my head and kept on proliferating in the way that ideas did. And one of the things I thought was, you wouldn't get an owl if it was Hogsmeade, you'd get a social worker. And I thought, well, you know, you can't be just any old social worker. I thought, what if it's the goddess of the River Thames, you see? And what if the goddess of the River Thames is a Nigerian woman who was actually a goddess of a small river in Nigeria and emigrated over and found the Thames had been vacated and moved in the same way that waves of immigrants into London would take over corner shops and kebabs. And like when I started, you see all the chip shops were run by Chinese people and now they're all run by Kurds. Because like waves of people will come over and they will take over these kind of small businesses, these businesses that you can run as a family, the food industry and everything. So I thought, well, that's okay. And then when I came to write the book, I just took that character and I thought, that's an interesting idea. And then because it was a book and it wasn't a TV series, then it could grow. It could grow outside of the constraints of what I'd have to sell to a producer. And so therefore, she became much more magisterial and much more like grand.
Oh, scary.
And scary. Well, if you think about it, you know, if you are the goddess of the tidal path of the River Thames, you're talking about massive power. By anybody's standards.
But then, interestingly, she comes up against Father Thames, who's part of an older, either sort of Romany or even ancient Roman tradition.
Romano-Celt. He's a Romano-Celt. And so you go all the way back to the Roman conquest of Britain. And what people don't realise is that London was a Romano-Celt city. The actual number of Italians living in London would have been actually quite low. The people who were actually living in Londinium were mostly Romano-Celts. You know, Celtic people, Britons who had become Romanized. And the Romans were very clever about kind of like just adopting local deities. And this is where the idea of genius loci come from. And So I thought, well, okay, there's always been talk of Father Thames and everything. And I thought, well, what if you have Father Thames? He's ancient. He goes all the way back to the Romano Celt bit, but he left London during the Great Stink in, I think, 1854, something like that, when River Thames became so polluted that they practically evacuated the city. You know, all the posh people did anyway. After that, they put the sewers in. And they culverted a lot of these old rivers, a lot of the ancient rivers of London, which things like the Tyburn and the Fleet and things like that became part of the sewer system, and so therefore ceased to become natural rivers in a way. And I thought, well, that's when he left, and the London was kind of empty, deprived of this vital part of its kind of spiritual life, until this Nigerian nurse turns up and tries to throw herself off London Bridge and gets made an offer she can't refuse. And you know, and you can read it as an allegory as much as you like or not, because it didn't start as an allegory. I don't write allegories.
No, these are all very much present contemporary characters who happen to be magical or happen to be the river.
Yes.
Meeting this young, black, smart, nicely dressed PC.
Well, yes, he is very nice. The thing is, when I created PC Grant, there's a template. Do you know how Columbo was made? I always tell this story. Columbo was made, came about because in the late 60s, they decided to make a conscious attempt to take all the American cop show cliches, which is all clean-shaven men with hats who fast with their fists and their guns and, you know, asked straight questions and never fumbled and never, you know, drove fast cars and chasing cars. And they turn them on their heads so that you have this shambling guy who's, you never see Columbo pull a gun. You know, he doesn't look like a police officer. He never carries a gun. And he certainly never hits anyone during the course of his thing. And he outwits his opponents by kind of slowly grinding them down and looking like a stupid guy. And he has a dog and a happy marriage, right? And I thought, I'm going to do that. And I'm going to do that with the contemporary police officer, of which we have thousands in Britain, especially in literary. So you have Rebus and various depressed Scandinavians and all that kind of stuff. And I thought, right, well, the standard British police officer is a middle-aged man who's drinking himself into an early grave or out of his marriage, who doesn't really get on with his superiors and is a maverick and doesn't like modern world. And I thought, right, I'm going to have a young man who's perfectly fit, doesn't drink, you know. And
actually good on technology.
He's good on technology, likes the system, understands how it works, and is good at paperwork. You see, that's the thing. And so I just reversed all those things, and that's how PC Grant came out. That was basically his genesis. And so therefore, once you start with that character, then certain things sort of like flow. What was the question again? I forgot what the question was.
So have I by this point. Ben, I only discovered your series about 3 weeks ago. I read the first novel, Rivers of London. Within a week, I had read the first five. So they're terribly addictive. In the fifth one, Peter left London. Tell me that he's coming back to London.
Oh, yes. No, he's gone all the way back to London. He's already back in London.
Ben Aronovich, thank you so much for speaking to us on RN.
It's been my pleasure.
The Rivers of London series is published by Gallants. You're listening to Books Plus on RN. There are more literary ghosties about.
Just a perfect day. Problems all left alone. Weekenders on our own. It's such fun.
Like Ben Aronovich, Mike Carey is also part of the graphic novel and comic fantasy end of things. 2 years ago, his apocalyptic zombie tale, The Girl with All the Gifts, became a bestseller. His latest outing is much darker than anything he's written before. A woman in prison is haunted by the ghost of the little boy she killed in his novel, Fellside. He writes as M.R. Carey, but to Fiona Gruber, he's just Mike.
You just keep me hanging on. You just keep me hanging on.
When I picked up this novel, I was hooked from the first sentence, which reads, "It's a strange thing to wake up not knowing who you are. We're in a hospital, the patient can't remember her name, but she senses that something terrible has happened." So, Mike, tell us about Jess Molson.
In many ways, she's a protagonist who it's difficult to sympathise with initially, I think. I mean, she's done a terrible thing, although she doesn't remember doing it. She's a drug addict. She's been in an abusive relationship for many years. And in an attempt to escape from that situation, one night when she's very high on heroin, she burns her apartment down. She's trying to kill her abusive boyfriend, but the boyfriend gets away clean. The little boy, Alex Beach, who lives in the apartment upstairs, is killed in the blaze. Jess is arrested and tried for his death and sentenced to a long spell in prison in Fellside, which is a Titan prison on the Yorkshire Moors. But she judges herself somewhat more harshly than that. She decides that she has to die for what she's done, and she goes on hunger strike. And then when she's at her lowest ebb, she meets the ghost of the boy, an apparition that looks like the boy, who says she can't die yet, it's not going to be that easy for her, that there are things that she still needs to do.
Yes, that's an extraordinary powerful moment, because the supernatural element to the book creeps up on you. As you said, Jess has got very low self-esteem, hasn't she? And she is tortured by what she's done.
Yes.
And then she goes into one of the harshest, nastiest regimes, Fellside Prison. Did you decide to create a prison drama and then work the story around that, or did you decide to write a supernatural work of fiction and then put it in prison afterwards? How did this actually develop?
Well, I think the two kind of sparks that ignited the story were the setting and the idea of having an addict or a recovering addict as the protagonist. I very much like confined settings. I find them fascinating from a storytelling point of view. Settings in which a small group of people are forced to interact with each other and there's really no escape from the situation or from the relationships. But the other sort of wellspring for the story was Jess's addiction. I've known a lot of addicts. I've been addicted myself in small ways that have not been sort of life-threatening. But I've known a lot of people who've either been destroyed by addiction or have fought back very bravely against it and have managed to conquer it and put their lives back together again. So it's a theme that I think I always wanted to tackle but was always a little afraid of, and it just felt like the right time.
Yes, because you do draw her very sympathetically, and you also point out that this is a character who she might feel she's consumed by the drug she's addicted to, but that's only one part of her. She's an intelligent woman, she has a lovely relationship with her aunt, who seems to be the only person who really cares for her. She cares for the little boy, the unhappy little boy Alex, who lives upstairs. She's really a rounded character. And then, of course, when she's in prison, she reveals herself not only to have these supernatural gifts, but also to have real resilience against this really corrupt and brutal regime, doesn't she?
Yes, it's a sort of odd and very unequal battle at the heart of the book. The sort of big antagonist in the story is Harriet Grace, the woman who runs the rackets in the prison, or rather at least in the maximum security part of the prison. And you know, from an outsider's point of view, Grace has all the big guns because she has a lot of sway with the inmates in the wing. She has corrupt guards more or less at her beck and call. Even the governor is a little wary of upsetting her. And Jess has nothing, but she is sort of forced to fight against Grace in order to survive long enough to sort of figure out what it is she's meant to do. If this is a chance at redemption, she wants to grasp it with both hands, but Grace is kind of in the way of that. And I think she grows in confidence and stature through the book as she sort of steps into the role that's being offered to her.
Did you do a lot of research into women's prisons for this? Did you visit any?
I did visit some, yeah. I've spoken to inmates and ex-inmates at some of the biggest prisons in the UK to reflect on some of the things that I'd learned about the state of the prison service, which is very much in flux, and I think you could say in crisis in the UK. So yes, I talked to inmates, I talked to people who do drug rehab in prisons and also in the London boroughs, liaising with the prison service. I also had a little bit of my own experience to draw on because I used to be a legal clerk for a firm of solicitors and had done a number of prison visits back when I was in that job. That was a long time ago, though, I have to say.
Oh, so you're a bit like Levine, the law clerk who falls in love with Jess. I'm not wanting to spoil anything.
Only a little bit, yeah. I very much liked writing Levine because I think he's an incredibly well-intentioned character and sort of out of his depth.
Totally out of his depth.
But his relationship with Jess was very enjoyable to write. You know, this sort of kind of hopeless romantic yearning.
So on one level, we're looking at a, you know, realist novel that's looking at the social ills of the private prison system, of addiction, of rehabilitation. But then on another level, we're in a kind of moral universe of redemption versus evil and the tussle between light and dark. And Jess, who seems to be able to visit the realms of the dead.
Yes, and I think that that's very much the sort of conundrum I had to solve when I was writing the story. I had to weld those two aspects of the novel together. And I think if it works, it works through the medium of the ghost, because the ghost is in many ways kind of the visible sign of Jess's quest to redeem herself, her quest for some kind of atonement for what she's done. So that as well as being a character in the story, he's also charged with a lot of symbolic value.
Well, that's right. I love the bit where when she first enters this realm and meets the little boy, she doesn't really have a body. She has to build the body herself by thinking about arms and legs, and then they grow. And I have to say, I did read a bit about you where you'd said that when you were a child, you were one of those ominously quiet kids who lived so much inside his own head, he only had vestigial limbs. So this sort of makes you sound like a brooding little blob.
Yeah, if I'd grown up in America, I might have come to a bad end in a country that had guns. No, I'm sorry, that's a terrible thing to say. But it's true, I lived a lot in my imagination.
What's so interesting, one of the many things that's interesting about you, Mike, of course, is that you come out of a comic and graphic novel background. So you studied at Oxford, and then you went into teaching with a foray into law clerkship. And then you've spent, what, a couple of decades writing graphic novels and yep. comic novels for 2000 AD, DC Comics, and some really famous series like X-Men and The Sandman and Hellblazer. A, why did you go into comics? And B, have you come out of them? Or are you now running two parallel careers?
I'm actually running about three or four parallel careers. Why comics? I guess because they were always a huge part of my life growing up. I mean, I learned to read from comics. And when I discovered the American superhero books when I would have been about 6 or 7 years old, they kind of, you know, really lit up the inside of my head. They were one of the things that sort of impelled me to explore fantasy and sci-fi as genres. So when I started writing, the idea of writing for comics was very appealing. I started off doing comics journalism, and then through that, I made contact with some editors and started pitching ideas for stories. And it was only really when I've been doing that for about 6 or 7 years that I started to write novels alongside the comics. I think writing comics taught me about structure. It taught me to structure stories.
Well, you have to be pretty direct, don't you? And you have to cut to the chase quite quickly, don't you?
You do. You've got a very limited canvas, and it's a canvas of a fixed size. If you're writing a monthly comic book, it's got 22 pages, or it might be 20 pages. And within that, you've got to sort of get in, tell your story, get out again, end on a good climax or a good cliffhanger. So you learn to budget pages and story beats.
So you've gone from bubbles, you know, with a few words in them and a very short bridging paragraph to 60, 70, 80,000 words. Isn't that a big leap?
Actually, it was very easy and kind of joyous, because whereas with a comic, the canvas is fixed, you can't borrow an extra page. With a novel, the canvas is what you say it is. And if you get to a certain point and you think, you know, I really want to explore this subplot, you can. If you want to go back when you've nearly finished and add an extra chapter, add some flashbacks, add a new character, change the point of view, you've got that freedom. You know, you live with a book for 9 months perhaps, or even a year, and within that time you can, at any point, you can make very profound structural changes. So I kind of got drunk on the power and the freedom when I wrote my first novels. It felt very easy and very natural. It was much harder to go from writing novels to writing screenplays, it has to be said.
Well, that's right, because you wrote a screenplay based on your 2014 novel, The Girl with All the Gifts, which was a big success, an apocalyptic tale of flesh-eating zombies. Is the film actually going to be made? What's happening with it?
I'm glad you asked. It's been made. It's just come out of post-production. It's currently being graded, which is the last sort of technical stage in polishing up the print. We're looking for a release towards the end of this year.
Wow. Well, that's very exciting. Do we see Fellside as possibly being a movie too?
Well, the movie of The Girl with All the Gifts, I developed that screenplay with an incredibly gifted producer, Camille Gatin, a French producer living in England, and one of the best directors that the UK has, Colin McCarthy. And working on it with those two people was kind of a masterclass for me. I think it really brought me on. And I think the screenplay that I wrote for Girl is far and away the best screenwriting I've done. And then when we were done, when we were finished, both Colin and Cammy turned around and said, what should we do next? And I said, well, I have this novel, which is a ghost story set in a prison. And They've optioned it. Yeah, they've acquired the rights, and we're working on an outline for a Fellside movie as we speak.
How fabulous. So who's starring in The Girl with All the Gifts?
The casting was just unbelievable. I couldn't have asked for better. There's the little girl who plays the sort of 10-year-old zombie who is the protagonist, and she was a girl making her feature debut, Senya Nanowa. Around her, we have some amazing adult actors. Glenn Close plays Caroline Caldwell. Gemma Arterton plays Helen Justineau, the teacher who Melanie adores. And Paddy Considine plays Sergeant Parks, the sort of gruff soldier who is assigned to guard her.
This is fantastic.
It's dream casting. And I got to meet them all on set, and I had a little role in the movie. I was one of the zombies.
Oh, fantastic. So you were one of the zombies. That's brilliant. I'm looking forward to it coming out enormously. Now, you would think, though, that The Girl with All the Gifts and Fellside, two very different novels. But, you know, one is, as I said, flesh-eating zombies in an apocalyptic dystopian future, and Fellside sort of in the present, but a gritty ghost story. But the thing at the heart of both of them is the relationship between an adult and a child, isn't it?
Yeah, this is true. And it's kind of, I think, family relationships, and especially parent-child relationships, are a theme that I sort of keep going back to in all of my writing. My big comics breakthrough was Lucifer, which was the sequel to The Sandman, or at least it was set in the same universe as The Sandman. And it's the story of the devil after he resigns from hell and comes to live on Earth.
Oh, that's right. And he looks like David Bowie, doesn't he? That was the brief to the illustrator, wasn't it?
Yeah, he looks very much like David Bowie. It has some of that kind of saturnine charisma. But the way we played it, we being me and my sort of various art teams over the years, we wrote it as a story of a dysfunctional family, with Lucifer as the rebellious son and God, Yahweh, as the overly controlling parent. And it's Lucifer trying to assert himself against his father, trying to find a way to be himself and break free of his father's influence, which, when your father is God, is very hard to do. So I think in all of my writing, there is this kind of exploration of the way parent-child relationships can go wrong, but also how incredibly fulfilling they can be.
Well, I don't want to give away anything about Fellside, but I have to say that there were so many twists and turns in the story, I didn't expect the middle or the ending. So
that's great to hear.
Yeah, well, thanks very much indeed, Mike.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on the show.
M.R. Carey with Fiona Gruber. His book, Fellside, is published by Hachette. Fictional or fantasy death is, of course, different to reality. But American writer Jim Bernard was interested in an intersection of the two. He became fascinated by the end, the last page, of well-known writers, and he decided to track them in a book called Final Chapters, How Famous Authors Died. He joined Michael Cathcart from Houston, and not surprisingly, Michael wondered where this morbid interest began.
But it started when I was doing a play. I'm an actor as well as a writer, and I was in a play in which I had a speech about the Greek playwright Aeschylus. And he died in a very unusual manner. He had a very shiny bald head, and he was out walking on a deserted part of the beach one day when an eagle dropped a turtle on his head, thinking it was a rock so he could crack the turtle open. And unfortunately, it did poor old Aeschylus in, and it didn't even crack the turtle's shell. So I began to wonder after this about other writers and whether they had unusual means of death, and many of them did. And then I began to find out that most of them wrote something about death during the course of their writing careers, which illuminated the thoughts they had about the impending mortality that faces us all. And so that was the idea for the book over a period of several years that went into the making, and I finally wound up with about 105 writers, I think, in the book. They start with Aeschylus, and they end up with the American film critic Roger Ebert, who just died a couple of years ago.
Well, you've found exactly the right tone for this, Jim, because actually it's a very buoyant book you've written. It is amusing as you go along, but it gets respectful when you need to.
But so, you know, it's something that Marcus Aurelius said, the emperor, who was also quite a philosopher, and I've tried to keep this in mind as I wrote the book. Death smiles at us all, and all we can do is smile back.
I'm not sure how consoling that is, really, but I guess we have to take it. Now, what you didn't tell us, Jim, is that Aeschylus was actually outside for a reason.
Well, he had heard from a prophet that a house was going to fall upon him, and so he spent as much time as he could in the outdoors because he didn't want a house to fall upon him and kill him. Well, ironically, the house that the turtle lived in, the turtle's portable house, is what fell on him when the eagle dropped it. So he did not escape the prophecy after all.
Yes, beware of those prophets, because they'll get you one way in the end, especially those Greek prophets, because they just traded in ambiguity, your Greek prophets. They always trip you up.
But they knew whereof they spoke.
They knew whereof they spoke, indeed. And Aeschylus had obviously known that he was going to die. Well, everyone knows he's going to die, but he had prepared for his own death by writing his epitaph.
Yes, a very nice epitaph that he prepared for himself. In this tomb, in the wheat fields of Gela, lies Aeschylus of Athens, son of Euphorion. He fought in the hallowed precincts of Marathon, which can speak of his valor, which is remembered as well by the long-haired Persians. He had been a soldier before he was a playwright and a poet, so he wanted his military exploits to be remembered more than anything.
I like the way he makes the Persians sound like they're a bunch of hippies.
The long-haired Persians. Yes.
Now, Voltaire, let's talk about the French writer and philosopher Voltaire. His mother had obviously told him to sit up straight at all times.
And he did sit up straight until he reached the grave, apparently. When Voltaire died, he was not in good favor with the Catholic Church. He'd been very critical of them, and while they tried to get him to convert on his deathbed, they asked him to renounce the devil. And he said, well, now is not the time to make any enemies that I don't already have. So he died not in favor with the church. But his nephew was a churchman, was a priest, in fact, at a parish somewhere outside Paris, and he wanted his uncle to have a church burial. And so, to thwart the authorities who would have prevented it had they known it was going to happen, they dressed Voltaire after he had died in his finest clothes, propped him up in a carriage, drove him through the streets of Paris as though he were still living, and finally got him out to the town outside Paris where he did, in fact, have a church burial.
It's really the premise for a Hollywood screwball comedy, isn't it?
Whether someone was sitting behind him waving at the people as he passed, raising his hand up and down, I don't know. That's not
right. Now you're being disrespectful.
I'm so sorry. Forgive me.
Let's raise the tone by speaking of Agatha Christie, who died a perfectly normal death.
Yes, at a ripe old age. She, of course, dealt a lot with death during her career, of about 60 novels, as I recall, in all of which somebody died. But she was very careful with estate, as I understand. She only wrote one novel a year to avoid excessive taxes. And by the time she died, she had a very small estate left because she'd been very careful about disposing of it before her death.
Yes, it would have been sweet for your purposes if Agatha Christie had been poisoned by somebody or other. But alas, she just died.
Unfortunately. She did have a very interesting episode in the middle of her life when her husband was having an affair with a good friend of theirs. And she had a kind of nervous breakdown and disappeared for about a week. And all kinds of people began to search for her, not only her husband and the police, but also Arthur Conan Doyle, the author of the Sherlock Holmes novels, was out looking for her. And Dorothy Sayers, one of her fellow mystery writers, was called in to help in the search. And they finally found her many, many miles from her home in a hotel where she was registered under an assumed name. But she got over that and came back and began to do her long career of wonderful mysteries.
Conan Doyle had some very interesting ideas about death.
Well, Conan Doyle thought he could communicate with the dead. He was a spiritualist, and he tried and claimed he was speaking with all kinds of deceased British celebrities. And upon his funeral, he had a medium there who had a vacant seat for him. Nobody could see if he was sitting at it or not. But the medium claimed afterwards that he had spoken to her during the funeral service. All that she reported that he said was that she was doing a wonderful job. And nobody else, of course, heard him say anything.
Yes, and no one could contradict that one. Now, the book isn't all flip, we should make it clear, Jim.
No,
of
course not.
You do get quite serious. And the story of Virginia Woolf dying, which I guess most people will know, you've told very, very tenderly. Just remind us how Virginia Woolf died.
Well, she was very disturbed mentally by we know not what. I think the chapter begins, what was Virginia Woolf afraid of? But she left her husband a note saying she simply could not take it any longer. And then she put on her top coat, filled the pockets with stones, heavy stones, and walked into the river near their home in southern England. And her body was found about a month later.
Yeah, it's a terribly sad end. And Hemingway also suicided.
With a shotgun, yes, which his wife at first claimed had been an accident while he was cleaning it, but later admitted it had been purposeful suicide on his part.
And he does seem to have been troubled by depression, but also by terrible pain.
Yes, indeed. He had been injured severely in several plane crashes in Africa, and for the last several years of his life was in dreadful pain. It turned out he suffered from a blood deficiency, which may have also contributed to his mental state and to his suicide. But he was very young, in his early 60s, and again, another tragic loss of a writer whose promise was not ever fulfilled completely because he died so young.
Yeah. One of the mysteries of life is how Dylan Thomas stayed alive so long, because every time you see Dylan Thomas, he looks as though he's in his cups. Even that voice, that wonderful voice he had, you know, sounds to me as though it's
well, yes, I wish I could emulate his voice. It was fabulous. You know, he famously told his mistress in New York, where he was on a book tour, "I have just had 18 straight whiskies. I think that's a record."
Mm.
Well, it has been challenged as to whether anybody could actually drink 18 straight whiskeys, so it may have been a little hyperbole on Dylan Thomas's part. And certainly he was drinking very heavily, not only during that period of his life, but during most of his adult life. He was quite a heavy drinker, which did contribute to his death. But his final cause of death was not 18 straight whiskeys, according to the medical reports, but some undiagnosed diseases, emphysema and diabetes, which they didn't realize he was suffering from.
Now, Jim, when you draw it all together, did you come to the conclusion that writers, that authors have a different kind of relationship with death from the rest of us?
Well, they're certainly more introspective about it. Most of them had something to say about death in their plays, their novels, their poems, and they thought about it. They approached it in different ways, although many of them very much like us. Some were quite religious and expected to have an afterlife in another world. Some, of course, were not religious and thought that death was the end of everything. Some were quite indifferent to it, a little flip about it, I think. So there were a variety of attitudes, just as I suppose most of us variously have a variety of attitudes depending upon our particular beliefs.
And where has it left you? Are you more reconciled to death, more at peace with death than you might have been before? Or have you always taken death as inevitable and been reconciled?
Well, I suppose there is a certain comfort to know that it does happen to everybody. And of all the people yet born, I think I mentioned in the introduction to the book, 97% of them have died already, leaving only a very small percentage of us left, which indicates that it's just something that mankind has to face.
That doesn't sound comforting to me. That sounds lonely, Jim. That's a terrible way to put it. Now, you've done some calculations, and this is an astonishing thing. You've worked out that in classical times, writers actually lived longer than they have lived in modern times.
Well, the average in this book of the classical writers was several years older at the time of their death than are the modern writers. And I think some of that can be attributed to tobacco, the prevalence of alcohol in modern life, drugs of various kinds, and the anxiety of living in modern life, which did cause a lot of stress and that sort of thing. But curiously, even though for the general population, longevity has been much, much greater in recent times, for the writers in this book, at any rate, they lived longer in the classical period.
Well, Jim, congratulations on the book. It's, in a strange way, quite fun to read. Thank you so much for being my guest.
Thank you very much, Michael. It's been a pleasure to be with you.
Jim Bernard is the author of Final Chapters, How Famous Authors Died. It's published by Skyhorse Publishing. Finally on Books Plus, on RN and Radio Australia, the writer of historical fantasy, Leon Hearn, who's also the children's and young adult author, Gillian Rubinstein. Here, Georgia Moody is mostly talking to the pseudonymous author, Leon Hearn, whose series, Tales the Otari, is wildly popular. It's sold 4 million copies worldwide and has been translated into 40 languages. Her new novel is set 300 years before that best-selling series. Over to Georgia Moody.
Leon, this novel, Emperor of the Eight Islands, is the first in a two-part prequel to your much-loved Tales of the Otari series. What prompted you to write this novel?
In a way, it's not so much a prequel as something that kind of happened like that. I didn't intend it to be a prequel. But two things happened at the same time, which I suppose turned it into a prequel in the end. One was that I was in Iwate Prefecture in Tohoku in northern Japan with some friends, and they took me to see two types of folk dancing there. And there was something about seeing these dances, seeing the young men in their masks and their costumes, that gives you the feeling that you're looking back into deep time, that you're seeing something from a very ancient past. And as I was watching this, I kind of had the idea that I would like to set a novel back in that time. And around the same time, two fans wrote separately asking about someone who is mentioned very briefly in the final Otori book, Heaven's Net is Wide, Otori Takeyoshi. And some boys are talking about legendary heroes at the shrine, and they just mention him as the founder of the Otori clan. These fans wrote and said, why don't you tell us more about this guy? He sounds interesting. And so these two things came together, and I thought, well, I could write something that goes back to that era, set it in the same world, and try to capture some of the feelings I had when I saw these young men doing the deer dance and the oni dances, the monster dances in Iwate Prefecture.
Leon, the central character of this novel is a young boy called Kazumaru. Who is he?
I suppose he's one of my classic heroes in that he's misunderstood and ill-used until he finds out that he has powers that he didn't know about. In this case, he gets taken over by two sorcerers and is given power by each of them and becomes quite a powerful sorcerer himself.
Before he becomes a sorcerer, he is a young boy, a 15-year-old, and his uncle wants to get rid of him because he's quite inconvenient. If Kazumaru becomes of age, he will inherit the estate that his father left to him.
That's right.
So there's a crucial hunting trip at the beginning of your novel. Tell me about what happens on that trip.
Well, on this hunting trip, they are going out in pursuit of an old stag who the uncle very much wants to capture. But on the way, Kazumaru begins to realise that he may not come back from this trip alive. And in fact, at the crucial moment, he seems to be falling to his death over the cliff, but the stag falls at the same time and breaks his fall. So he gathers up the skull and the hide of the stag and sets out into the forest with them, and then comes to the hut of the mountain sorcerer.
And who is he? Tell us about this mountain sorcerer.
He's called Shisoku. He's one of the old people who lived in the forest since ever and ever and who know all its secrets and all its animals. And he's obsessed with recreating animals, so he makes all of these fake wolves and bears and crows and all sorts of other creatures, and some of them work and some of them don't. And so his hut is like a sort of microcosm of things going on, things being created and things being discovered.
Leon, like the main character of this novel, you've taken on a new name. Before your Otori series, you were best known as the children's author Gillian Rubinstein. Why did you decide to take on a pseudonym for your book set in Japan?
They seemed to be a completely new departure from the children's books. They were for an adult audience, and I suppose I just wanted to make a complete break with the past writer that I'd been. And also, it's a very Japanese thing, which is very annoying for historians, to change your name when you come to a new stage in your life. So you'll find that a lot of Japanese historical characters and artists have many different names during the course of their life. And so it seemed to be something that would be interesting to do.
I know that you've studied Japanese and that you regularly travel to Japan. What is it that draws you so strongly to Japanese culture and history?
For some reason, I've been interested in it almost all my life, and I'm not really quite sure why. I mean, I can understand why, because it's such a hugely fascinating and rich culture and history. It's just something that you would never get to the end of studying and trying to understand and learning more and more about. And so that aspect of why is always really very hard to answer. My Japanese friends say, well, it's obvious that you were Japanese in a former life, but I'm not sure that I believe that.
It seems to me like this world is seething with lust. Why is that?
I think it was something that I was quite interested, even from the first thinking about the book, was this idea of lust as a force of nature, and that the world is sort of seething with recreating itself and reproducing itself. And the whole thing is a kind of seething turmoil of all animals seeking to reproduce themselves. And I think that aspect of nature that you get in Japanese writing and films is something that appealed to me very much, that nature is a very powerful thing, not always benevolent, often very dangerous and cruel, but it is the world we live in, and even though it's full of peril, it's also very beautiful. I think this book has even more sex probably than the Otori books, because it looks at the power of sex and of using that power of sex in shaping people's lives.
It's also a savage world, a world in which death is just around the corner, and you're not afraid to kill off central characters who we've come to care about. Is that an exciting prospect for a novelist?
No, I always rather dread it, actually. I hate that moment when you come to that point in the plot and you realise that things have converged so that this character has to lose their life. It's always very painful. But sometimes it is necessary for the plot. It's the way that you have set things up, and things have to come to their logical conclusions. So I don't think we can talk about specifics here because it will spoil things for people, but there are characters that I was extremely fond of that I didn't like to kill off, but it just seemed to happen that that was the way it was.
The female characters in this world are so constrained. They live at the mercy of these powerful warlords, and often they have to disembowel themselves because the honour code dictates it. Do you find it similarly restrictive when you're creating female characters, that they're so often powerless?
I think they have their own power, and I think that is what makes them fascinating to write about. Japanese history is very, very male-dominated when you read about it. Women don't get mentioned very often. But of course, men and women have had relationships always and always will have. And women have their own sorts of power in these worlds that maybe don't get recorded but are still very much there. So it's a sort of case of looking into poetry and literature of the time and looking at ways that women lived and how they were able to have influence in their lives. So I find writing against that constraint very interesting and very challenging.
Leanne, this is now the eighth novel that you've written under the pen name Leanne Hearn. The ninth will be the second in the Tale of Shikinoko series. What is it about Japanese history that continues to inspire you?
Each time I think that I might be finished with this subject, I find something else that's absolutely intriguing. And I think, well, that would just make such a great base for a novel. It's endlessly fascinating to me. And one of the ways that I come to understand it is by writing about it. I think that we all do this when we write, that we write to find out what it is that we think about things and how it is that we understand the world.
Georgia Moody speaking to Leanne Hearn, who's also the writer Gillian Rubinstein. Her new book is Emperor of the Eight Islands, The Tale of Shikinoko, and it's published by Hachette. You can listen to a longer version of that interview at abc.net.au/rn. While you're there, you can find many other books and interviews and links. I'm Kate Evans, and that's it for Books Plus this week. Many thanks to Sue Clark. Next week, a crime novel from former federal parliamentarian Lindsay Tanner, and much else beside. Meanwhile, do stay with RN.